The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion on current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to keep on top of the torrent of news coming out of China through our daily email newsletter, our handy smartphone app, and of course, at our website, subchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I am in New York this week, where I'm joined by Mr. Jeremy Goldkorn, who just won't know what to do with himself now that Senator Bob Corker is not going to be running for re-election, since, you know, Jeremy's been calling him every day since the election last November. Jeremy, man, what are you going to do with yourself?
Well,
you have all this time now.
There'll be another senator.
Right.
And that app that I use, Five Calls, it gives you, you know, several issues every day and the right number of your local representatives to call. So there's a bunch of people on my list.
Pester the polls.
That's what I'm for. That's what I came to America for. Anyway, a few episodes ago, I recommended the book Little Soldiers, An American Boy, A Chinese School, and the Global Race to Achieve. Today, we are delighted to be talking to that book's author, Lenora Chu. Lenora has worked as both a television and print journalist, and she still lives in Shanghai with her husband, Rob Schmitz, who's been a guest on our show a couple of times, and her two boys, Rainey and Landon. She's now touring in support of this wonderful book that Kaiser and I both thoroughly enjoyed. Lenora, welcome to Cynega.
Thank you for having me.
Lenora, I think Jeremy and I liked the book so much, in no small measure, because we've both raised young children in China. Well, Jeremy moved his over earlier than I did, but then, you know, we did move to the U.S., and we've been both puzzling through exactly the same sorts of issues at the center of Little Soldiers. More than that, I think that it wasn't just about your parenting journey. I mean, you really talk about, you get to the heart of the major issues that are really bedeviling both the Chinese and the American pedagogical systems.
It's not just a memoir. There's a lot of research and a lot of information in it about the Chinese educational system.
Yeah. More than that, I mean, I thought it was just tremendously well written and smartly observed and really entertaining, too. I think, you know, parents, no matter whether they're raising kids here or there, they're going to benefit from reading it. It's the kind of thing, you know, I've been talking
about educators as well, actually.
Yeah,
I've had a lot of response from educators.
Oh, yeah.
Who have been interested to know exactly how the Chinese system works, because there's been a lot said about it, but really very little, you know, a deep dive.
It's the kind of thing that I'm just going to be talking about constantly with my wife, and we're always talking about it. I can't wait for a Chinese version of it to come out. There is a Chinese version of it coming out.
There have been offers, but yeah,
of course,
they have trouble with the political thought control chapter. So, yeah,
surprise.
Thought control in the classroom. Yes.
Anyway, I've been translating it on the fly to Fanfan, who, you know, thinks you pretty much nailed it in terms of identifying what's both praiseworthy and, you know, pathological and deeply fucked up about both systems. But let's set this up a bit. So you didn't just write a book on education in China as some dispassionate observer, but you actually really dove into the subject as much as one can. I mean, you involved your own flesh and blood in this.
That's right. Well, you know, it's funny. We moved to Shanghai in 2010, and our son, Rainer's his formal name, and in the book I call him Rainey, he was a year and a half at the time, and, you know, he's just a little baby. And I was working on a different book, actually, at the time. I was writing a book about Hollywood. But then all of these things started to happen in education and Shanghai, especially, you know, the world's focus was on the city because of that test,
right? The PISA.
The PISA.
Right.
And then, you know, when
I think we should explain that for people who weren't aware of it. It's
it's a test out of the OECD, and they go around and test 15-year-olds in pretty much, you know, nearly 70 countries. And Shanghai participated and came in number one in math, reading, and science. And it was a shock, you know, to many people. So, you know, I was watching all the news headlines, and then we actually happened to enroll our son in this sort of school just down the street. And it was this confluence of factors, and I shifted my focus really to this narrative.
Lenora, have you got an any pushback or criticism for subjecting your son not only to the rigors of the Chinese school system, but also putting him in a book?
Oh, that. Okay, so that's two separate questions. Let's tackle them one by one. So yes, I have gotten criticism, and I expected that. You know, everybody has an opinion about education and parenting. And then when you couple that with China, I mean, Kellogg, right? It's like fear and revulsion. But, you know, here's the thing. The Chinese understand what they're doing wrong. They really do. And later in my research and reporting, I understand that they get this. You know, my son is forced to do a few things that he doesn't want to do. That's not good for children. They've actually printed policy manuals saying, you know, authoritarianism in the classroom is not good. So these are the things that they're working on.
Yeah, I mean, I've encountered this too. In fact, I think something we'll talk about is how a lot of the resistance, I mean, it's not coming from the Ministry of Education or even from educators, it's coming from parents. But at what point did you decide you were going to actually write this book then? So you set out to write this book about, I mean, if I were to undertake something like this after the fact, I just wouldn't be able to shake free quite the level of detail.
I've always been, you know, as a writer, you're always taking notes every day, conversations that have happened. You know, I was watching my son go through this and I was fascinated by what he would say about it and then what I would hear parents say about it. And, you know, a lot of the Chinese parents around me really had the same concerns. We were trying to figure out what the hell was going on inside of that school because our kids would say the darndest things. You know, I was forced to eat an egg, or all we did was we sort of just sat all day long. Now, granted, these are three-year-olds, so part of you, you're sort of thinking, are they accurately describing
what's
going on?
How do you actually,
right? How do you sit all day long? And you know, that concerned me. So I started asking questions, you know, in the book, I began this sort of long-standing battle with the principals and teachers over access and getting my questions answered. And eventually, I have to broaden out to other classrooms and other students because I wasn't getting what I wanted. In answer to the second part of the question about writing about my son's journey, you know, it's funny, as a writer, there are ways to reveal without really revealing too much. And I hope I've accomplished that. I mean, I feel very comfortable with his presence in the narrative. You know, he's 9 now and we talked to him about it. You know, my husband has read the text. I don't really feel that, you know, we've invaded his privacy in any way.
Right.
So tell us about the school, about Song Qingling. It seems really, really brutal, almost like a caricature of what people imagine about Chinese education in some ways.
So Teacher Chen, first of all, I should say that Song Qingling is a pseudonym. The lawyers asked me to change the name of the school, probably for good reasons. Teacher Chen in the book, I would say, is very traditional, very authoritarian. She is a mean, one of those sort of teachers that actually people have been writing to me after reading the book about their Catholic school teachers. You know, she's authoritarian. She's mean. She thinks that she knows best and she's happy to let children know. You know, she actually sat 30 kids in a room and spooned eggs into their mouths until they swallowed. You know, she had very strict rules about when kids could get up for water, how long they had to lie still for nap, even they'd outgrown their nap. She was, you know, the picture of the authoritarian teacher.
Give me a picture of her. So how old is she, roughly?
Yeah, she's in her late 40s. Okay. And, you know, I always remember her teeth because she never smiled. And when you saw them, you knew you were in trouble because it was a grimace, you know, and it was always directed at me. Yes. And the principal also was very authoritarian, I would say. She had a lot of expectations for us. You know, during orientation, she said to 300 parents in a room, you know, we don't pick children, we pick parents. I once met a mother who bought two flutes, one for herself and one for her daughter so she could practice alongside.
The recorders, right?
That's right. I like that kind of parent, you know, and I look around and there are 300 bobbing heads and I realize this is going to be a family affair. So these were the expectations pretty much set upon parents from day one. I would say that that is the type of teacher where Chinese educators would like to move away from. Of course, I didn't know this in the beginning. You know, it took a little while to understand. And we learned from each other. And these conversations I had with her about individual choice and allowing children to choose what to eat, you know, she's learning from me just as I am learning from her.
Right. But she's hardly an outlier. There are lots of teacher Chens.
That's a great point. I've met people on tour, you know, people have come through the Chinese system and they say, you know, Teacher Chen was my teacher. I had Teacher Chen for 17 years and I came home and my dad was Teacher Chen. You know, this is an issue in the culture. It's very much about top-down authority.
So some of the most painful parts of the book for me to read as somebody who's lived in China and raised kids there is just the whole bit about gift giving. I mean, we stonewalled. We just played dumb or just never played along. And part of it was the fact that, you know, we were at Fang Chao Di, which I don't need to hide the name of, I mean, because they didn't have that culture.
But you do need to explain what Fang Saudi is.
So, yeah, Fang Saudi was an international school, and there were a lot of, you know, children of diplomats, and so they couldn't have gotten away with that sort of sort of naked avarice and expectation of bribery and gift giving. Tell us about your whole experience, though, with that whole expectation of gifts and the whole debacle of the handbags.
So I think most foreigners are generally able to escape this because, you know, the Chinese teacher will look at a foreigner and say, oh, they couldn't be possibly be expected to know what I'm talking about. But, you know, I sort of was in between. I'm sort of that Chinese face. I speak Mandarin. And at one point, she basically came up to me and offered her services, her tutoring services for money. And
extra
I had to decide what to do. It was called extra help. You know, at the same time, I'm hearing Chinese parents plan these sort of elaborate Chinese New Year gifts, you know, Louis Vuitton, Prada. I mean, this is a very, you know, upscale school and these families have money. And I start to wonder, what is all of that about? You know, and I find out that Coach is last year and this year it's Tory Burch, you know. But there definitely is an expectation if a teacher accepts a gift that she will, that expectation of reciprocity that maybe isn't as much part of the culture here, right?
Right.
And I think that's the difference.
And so what would the teachers do in...
I found reports of teachers assigning seating based on gifts, performance lineups. You know, it's supposed to be the tall kid in the middle, but for some reason it was this other kid. You know, you kind of wonder on what basis did she make that decision?
Yeah, you can look at the performance lineup and figure out how corrupt a particular educational institution
that's what
is.
They were, that's what they were saying about there. This teacher, right. You know? And in the countryside, too, it's, you know, money for textbooks that aren't on the syllabus, you know, getting the proper transcript requires money. There's a lot of gray money in the system. And the government realized this is a major problem.
Lenora, you introduce a couple of characters, Darcy and Amanda, who are both Chinese high school students enduring the travails of preparation for the Gaokao, the Chinese college entrance examination. Can you tell us about these two and the experiences that they've had with the Chinese education system?
There's actually one story in particular that I thought was really interesting, which was about the different readings they had of The Merchant of Venice.
Sure.
Because Amanda had studied in the States, like an exchange program as well as in Shanghai, and had, you know, I think that was a great apples to apples because they're both teaching the same Shakespeare
play. I don't remember the details of that story. Let me try to talk about it. You know, basically in the Chinese text, she was introduced to Shylock without understanding that he was ostracized for being a Jew. And so she comes over to America and is able to, for the first time in her junior high school classroom in New England, read Shakespeare, The Merchant of Venice, in its entirety. And she said, oh, society created the evil Shylock. You know, back in China, they used Shylock as, you know, an example of capitalism gone awry. So, you know, it's just a very interesting dichotomy for how the Chinese use particular texts to promote their message. And Darcy, unfortunately, is a high school kid I meet, and he breaks my heart because he's done everything right. He's class monitor, you know, he looks perfect from the outside, even his bangs are always perfect, you know, he's the highest math score, teachers love him, he's tapped to join the Communist Party at 18, which is very rare, there's usually only a few per high school, but I discover that he has secrets, right? He has a secret girlfriend, he has a mobile phone his father doesn't know about, you know, his parents wanted him to study so bad. They actually glopped glue all over the television button so he couldn't turn it on, and they hid the remote. But for 7 years, he even knew where the remote control is, right? It was in the toilet behind the commode. So this is the kind of dual life that he lived, you know? And I really began to talk to him about, you know, what did he really want individually? And he never felt that he could express himself in that way. He eventually does everything right. He gets into Jiao Tong University and studies basically what his parents had told him to study. I mean, this is a kid who has really done everything by the book. And frankly, I just checked in with him. You know, I've known him for 5 years, and he's studying something he doesn't want to study. He's about to graduate college, and he's not really sure what he wants to do with himself.
And how about Amanda? How did she fare?
So Amanda ended up at a U.S. university, and she is the example of, you know, she felt like she was always her parents' property. You know, even when she was in high school in the U.S., her parents, you know, her mother was diagnosed with breast cancer and they never told her. They didn't want to interfere with her studies for almost a year. She didn't even know her mother was sick until she came back to China. So it was all about, you know, making sure she's getting to that next level of education. Now she's doing great. She's at a university. She feels her math education was world class back in Shanghai, and it's prepared her well for an American education.
There's another story, too, that you introduced about Junjun, the son of a masseuse who I guess lives... She's, I guess, from rural Anhui, if I remember. And, you know, you chronicle this poor kid is getting ready to take the high school entrance exam. And I think, well, there's maybe a lot of people even listening to this show who aren't familiar with the fact, with this aspect of the Chinese education system, that you actually have to test into an academic high school, or you end up basically with the choice of dropping out or going to vocational high school, which, you know, shouldn't be shameful or anything. But I mean, I think it's probably unusual. China's probably unusual, at least among, you know, more developed countries, in having this sort of an exam at that point. You know, you take it presumably when you're, what, like 13 or 14, right?
Mm-hmm. 15, 16.
Okay. So tell us about Junjun and his mother. I guess she goes by Lauren. Is that right?
Sure, Lauren. Yeah, so it's interesting, you know, the Chinese education system compulsory is still only grades 1 through 9. And what's devastating for most families is really that high school entrance exam, Zongkao, right? There's a lot of media coverage of the college entrance exam, because I think in the U.S., there's equivalency there. We think SAT, we think college admissions. But the high school entrance exam, you lose 7-8 million kids every year. They're not able to advance into a normal academic high school. That's a lot of carnage, right? And so I watched this kid, Junjun, and I've known her mother for a number of years. She's a migrant worker that I meet in Shanghai. And the family is desperate. They have not lived together, father, mother, son, since Junjun was a baby. And all of a sudden, he turns 15, 16. He's about to take this exam, and he's going to fall off the educational ladder. And it's quite devastating to see him fail.
Yeah. I mean, he's had it really rough, right?
He's addicted to video games. He plays League of Legends. I mean, he's basically had zero parental supervision for most of his life.
He's been living in sort of these boarding houses.
Abusive
boarding homes. So he was living with his grandparents up until about the age of 11 or 12, transferred to a boarding home. And the boarding home, you know, is basically this headmistress who's taking money from migrant workers to house their children. And there's no supervision. And he gets slapped around a bit. You know, it's not a healthy environment for him at all.
Poor kid. Now, people talk a lot about whether China should abolish the Gaokao, because, you know, there's so many problems with the system, ranging from the stresses on teenagers to you know, the fact that it might not be the best way to prepare people for college, etc. But
the
there are reasons
cheating.
Why.
Yeah.
What's that?
The rampant cheating.
Rampant cheating. Yes.
Yeah.
But there are factors. There are reasons why it still persists. I mean, you know, one that you hear about a lot and seems to me to have some truth is that, a little like the old imperial examinations, it does provide a degree of social mobility to China. If you do well on the Gaokao, even if you're from, you know, some shithole town in the middle of nowhere, you can join China's elite.
That's right. And I think that China needs to sell that idea that it's a meritocracy. And the more I looked into the numbers, it's actually not. If you look at Shanghai, a kid born in Shanghai with a Shanghai hukou is 55 times more likely to get into Fudan University than the national average. Tsinghua, for example, took like 200 kids in 2016 from Beijing, and the same number from Hunan province, which has 96 million people. So there's massive inequality sort of built into the system. The problem is, China is having trouble moving away from this Gaokao, because every time you try to introduce human judgment, say essays or interviews, you know, now in Shanghai, they're even trying things like, okay, let's look at volunteering and outside activities. You introduce human judgment. And as we know, in China, human judgment can be bought. Right? It can be influenced. And so every time you try
really?
To swing in that direction, I know. Every time you try to swing in that direction, you start opening the back doors to all kinds of corruption.
Yeah.
Maybe we should issue a spoiler alert here, but I think that a lot of Americans who have made it 2/3 of the way through the book are going to be, you know, pretty surprised when they get to the chapter that's called Let's Do Math.
Okay.
Which is, you know, you kind of, let's say, you kind of lull the reader into a sense that everything about the oppressively authoritarian pedagogy was just bad and was just wrong. But then there's this chapter where you know, suddenly kind of talk quite a bit about, you know, what's to be said for the Chinese education system. Would it be fair to characterize your book as kind of a battle hymn of the tiger mother in reverse?
In reverse. Yeah, that's an interesting question. Somebody said to me, you're the anti-tiger mom. You know, I adore Amy Chua's great. She's endorsed the book, and I'm really appreciative of her support. But yeah, I really just wanted to look into this question of how do we educate our kids? And it, you know, balance, right? It's balance. But here's a question about math. Do we think math is important? Because I'm finding as I'm going on this tour, there are a lot of parents who say math is actually not that important.
Really?
That's just ridiculous.
And there are research studies that show primary school math skills correlate to earnings 20, 30 years down the line. These are major, you know, massive longitudinal studies. It is important. And I'm finding this sort of resistance to the idea of early academics here in the U.S. as I'm traveling around. It's very interesting. So that chapter is really about a comparison of how the Chinese teach math and how the Americans teach math. And I wanted to get into a Shanghai classroom and a Boston area classroom to really show the difference.
Let's talk about that. That is definitely one of the most intriguing, or at least for me, one of the most intriguing parts of the book. Can you tell us what you witnessed at those sessions in Boston and in Shanghai?
So what the Boston teacher was really great at doing is introducing a concept and then asking kids, what do you think about it? And not only that, let's apply what we just learned. And it's a very friendly classroom. The kids are sort of sitting in groups and she's at eye level talking to them. And there's a lot of dialogue. There's a lot of back and forth. The Shanghai classroom is really run very military style. There are 30 kids in a room and she's calling them by number. Student number two, you know, what is the square root of 9 or whatever it is. And kids are sort of popping up and answering her questions. It feels like a drill. It's like drill and kill. But if you actually talk to the experts, there are certain things in math that you need to memorize. That's just something that you need to do. And I found that in Shanghai, at least, multiplication tables are being cemented to memory in something like the second grade. And the average American public school classroom, it's not happening until a couple years later. And these international math experts are saying that's a little bit too late.
Huh. I remember math class when I was a kid. I mean, as early as second and third grade. And we play this all through primary school, this game called Around the World. I don't know if you, did you have this? So we'd organize ourselves in a circle and then she would do these flashcards. She'd pull up a multiplication problem and, you know, so somebody would start and they would stand next to another kid. And it was a competition. Whoever could answer the question correctly first got to advance. The other kid had to sit down. And then whoever made it all the way around that circle of chairs by defeating other people for how quickly they answered. I mean, so this is New York. This is, you know, upstate New York. I feel like American education has changed, that it was more like that. It was more rigorous and structured before, and that it sort of softened. Anyway, that's
kind of the great debate in American education right now. Where should we swing?
Yeah. I mean, at one point you suggest that China is still a country that rewards a nerd bonus, whether, you know, they're not so interested in your, you know, social skills or how you're dressed. I mean, if you're the
you're
you
tops
know,
in the class.
Yeah, the shibah.
It's like, right.
It's a cool thing. It's not, I
it's
mean,
a
you
cool
don't,
thing.
Right, right. It's yeah. a good thing to be. Whereas, you know, the U.S. still subtracts a nerd penalty. So China has had this sort of cult of the engineer, the very deeply technocratic society for a long time, whereas the U.S. has been plagued by this anti-intellectualism. You can still find it, regrettably, in the U.S. You know, it's the kind of anti-intellectualism that can, you know, propel a man described by our Secretary of State as a fucking moron into office, right? I mean, so is this part of this? I mean, is there like a culture of anti-intellectualism versus this sort of you know, land of nerd empowerment thing in China?
I mean, I think the nerd empowerment in China probably goes a little bit too far, and maybe
I would agree, yeah.
And maybe we swing too far in the other direction. You know, I grew up in a Texas high school. It was always football. Get this, you know, I tell the story sometimes, and I realize how crazy it is. Every football player in our high school was assigned 6 girls to decorate his house during football season and bake brownies and cookies for this one guy.
Really? My gosh.
It was called Spirit Club. This is nuts, right?
Yeah, you know? That's insane.
I mean, pretty extraordinary.
I mean, it's
but
nice
you were
if you're a
cheerleader, right?
Yeah, I was on the dance team. I was on the captain of the drill team. But can you imagine, you know, this would not happen in China. I mean, there's a completely different set of values. I always loved walking into the Chinese classroom and I would say, who's number one? And everybody knows, you know, 30 hands point to the kid in the front row. It almost became like, an interesting game to me. But, you know, that's what they value. It's just a completely different way of looking at what's important.
Lenore, you talked to Andreas Schleicher. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. And he's the architect of the PISA test, the international standardized test that we mentioned earlier. He had some very interesting observations about China's approach to teaching mathematics. Can you share, in essence, what he said?
So this will be a controversial view. I mean, I think all of the education experts are quite controversial in this space. But he basically is saying that it's the Americans who are doing rote memorization, not the Chinese. And he's saying that we in the U.S. classroom focus so much on application that we never get to a deeper conceptual understanding. So these kids never cement math to that back part of the brain, right? But the Chinese way looks like rote learning. If you read that chapter in my book, there is a lot of drilling and reciting. But then he says that they're able to move on to deeper concepts very quickly because there are certain things you just need to memorize. It enables higher order thinking.
You know, the math tutor that we hired for Johnny last year always talked about sort of numeracy and sort of a math sense. She always talked about this sort of ineffable quality that she said my son possessed, which was just like a feel for it. That some kids sort of either got it or they didn't. And I would sit down and I would ask her about, you know, so you've had a lot of experience with Asian kids and a lot of experience. And she said the same thing. She said that she thinks that the idea that the downplaying of so-called rote memorization is really misguided, that really imbuing kids with a feel for mathematics. That's quite important, ultimately.
That's true. There are certain things that still need to be memorized.
So you came to the conclusion that Chinese and Americans have basically come down on different sides of the old nature versus nurture debate, and that Chinese believe that it's really all about nurture, that we all start with the same intellectual endowments, and that we differentiate basically through how hard we apply ourselves, how disciplined we are. While Americans believe more in nature, that, you know, some of us are just born with heads for math and others just aren't. I guess I've suspected this too. I think about quotes like from Thomas Alva Edison, who used to say, you know, genius is 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. I mean, there is also a hard work ethic in America, isn't there? I mean,
sure.
But so do you think that it's as stark as you portrayed it? You know, the nature nurture thing?
Well, you know, it depends on where you are. I've noticed that, you know, when I give talks at schools in New York City, they feel that what I'm describing, that level of competition and that level of family support behind the kid and the hard work that I'm describing, their approach to education too. I think overall, you know, if you look at studies that have followed, you know, 5,000 children in various cultures, I think you can make that statement. But, you know, New York parents and Shanghai parents, they're not a lot different, frankly, as far as what we want for kids and our approach to education,
right?
Just because we are in these hyper competitive urban environments.
If you were to go back to that moment when you and Rob were deciding where to put Rainey in school, do you think you would still have chosen Songqingling?
Knowing what you know now?
What about you guys? What would you do?
I would go for Songqingling.
You would go for Songqingling?
If I could afford it, yeah.
I would have too. I mean, I in some ways regret that, unlike the two of you, you know, my children have...
They're younger, they're babies.
Yeah, I mean, they're in kindergarten in America, where the educational system is run by hippies. and I kind of would have preferred them to have a bit of Chinese discipline beaten into them when they're young. But
I definitely agree. I think that it's the kids are pretty resilient. I mean, you can include the same
yes.
thing. They can take a lot. I mean, and it's not going to kill the creativity. Again, in your book, and I would completely agree, it's mostly the home environment, and that's going to decide whether they're, you know, robotic automatons or. And that was just never a problem in my house. Anyway.
Yeah, right, no, of course right. not. And I think right. it's much easier for you to provide, you know, freedom and creativity at home than it is to provide, you know, the kind of Chinese school
that's
discipline.
Right.
Anyway,
what about you?
Yeah. Okay. Great. So I really worry about the kids who have Teacher Chen in the classroom, and they come home and they have a Teacher Chen father, or Teacher Chen mother, where they're never really exercising their own, you know, individual will or making their own decisions. I don't worry about that for my son. And he is now 9, and he's gotten all that signaling around how important education is. You know, when you walk into the classroom, you say hello to the teacher, you pack your own bag, you take responsibility for your progress and your grades. And, you know, it's interesting. The Chinese way is not the helicopter parent. It's not, you know, it's not hovering over your kid. It's really about getting the habits right in the early years and then sort of letting them go. And I feel like he's gotten all those habits and that discipline, you know, from his schooling environment. And I don't worry about him too much anymore.
So, I mean, I feel like when I finished the book, you hadn't just written a book about education. You'd actually written about something that I thought really got to the heart of just some fundamental differences between Chinese and Americans. You know, maybe there's a metaphor in here for Chinese savings versus American consumption, the Chinese sort of farsighted investment versus American short-term gratification. Was this kind of your intention somewhere?
Was it? No, you know, that's interesting. Not at all. I don't know how it got painted into such a U.S.-China thing. I mean, I guess...
You don't?
I mean, I guess because of, you know, because I'm American, because I spend time in American classrooms.
Those are the points of your comparison, aren't they?
I mean, yeah, I suppose, China, just because of who I am. That's true.
Yeah, but do you see what I'm getting at? I mean, I feel like as you read this, you see, I feel like it applies more broadly than just to the narrow field of education. I feel like
that's true. Yeah.
You know, there's these habits.
Well, it's
there's
this sort of group versus individual. That to me was the biggest thing that stuck out.
And
you know?
The chukwu thing and right. You know, the sort of deferred gratification.
Hard work, right.
And, right.
I think there's a fear, and we had talked about this earlier, this fear of pushing our kids too hard generally in the U.S. I'm not talking about Boston or New York or some of these cities, but I think generally all the language, you know, if you talk to teachers now, and I talked to a lot of American teachers for this book, they basically feel they don't have control of their classroom and they can't say to students, you need to work harder. You're not doing enough, because the parents will come down on them. You can't talk to my daughter that way. You can't talk to my son that way. Well, then who's going to say it? You know, because the parents aren't saying it. The teachers aren't saying it. I think there's a cultural difference in the way we look at education.
At one point, you underscore a huge difference between the U.S. and China, which is the fundamental issue of respect for teachers. You know, we've sort of hinted at that already in our discussion. In your early chapters, you know, the respect for the teacher assumes an almost monstrous form. But clearly, you come back in a later chapter to really emphasize how important it is and how it's absent in American educational culture. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So Teacher Chen demanded respect in many ways from the student and the parent. And I felt that she went a little bit overboard, obviously.
A lot of it.
Yeah. But if you actually look at the studies, the teacher's social status in China is tops in the world. Teachers are on par with doctors. There was a survey that came out in 2014. And the U.S., it's far below. You know, half of Chinese would encourage their kids to become teachers. Can you imagine that? In the U.S., it's something like less than a third. And the Chinese government, it's really interesting. They understand it's important to keep social status high because it keeps teachers coming into the pipeline. People want to move into the profession. And they've worked to double salaries, double the funding going to salaries over the last 5 or 6 years. In the U.S., you don't hear any of that kind of language, you know.
Yeah. Well, they've got to fight to even sort of keep the viability of their unions and things like that. It's really, really...
That's right. It's a totally different way of thinking about things. So...
Yeah, I mean, we have these stupid things like, you know, those who can't do teach. What the hell is that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas in China, if somebody's older than you or you respect them, you call them a teacher, even if they're not a teacher.
Right.
It is such a basic feature of the culture, isn't it?
It's funny. I've had people say to me while I'm on tour, I talk about this teacher respect, and somebody actually yelled out in the audience, I decide whether my teacher deserves respect. Not all teachers deserve respect. And that's kind of interesting that this person even felt empowered to say this. And there were teachers in the room. You know?
This was a student said this.
It was a parent.
A parent.
Yes, right. In the Bay Area.
In the bet, well.
That's what I'm talking about, regional differences, right? Yeah. It's a hard sell.
Yeah.
It's a hard sell.
I mean, does the Bay Area have the highest concentration of Waldorf schools in the United States?
It's possible, right? That's where a lot of the child-centered learning is really originating, is California.
Yeah. In California. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you see any way forward? I mean, how do we just imbue it in the culture to have more respect for teachers?
You know, when I told this parent, I said, it has to start somewhere. You know, if we're making individual decisions, like I did with Teacher Chen, I challenged her on pretty much everything I didn't like. And there was so much, you know. But if we're making individual decisions about whether our teachers are worthy of respect, we should just remember that they're in charge of our kids for 8 hours a day. I mean, they're really spending more time with our kids than we are. And that relationship alone, you know, think about it.
Right. I mean, it almost seems like a bland conclusion to say that there are things about both systems that are good and bad, and, you know, that we can learn from both. You know, Amy Chua's book sort of comes to that same conclusion. It is sort of all about a synthesis, but you can't just order off a menu, obviously. You can't just say, you know, yes on math rigor, this is what you said, or no to unblinking obedience. So how do you blend? I mean, actually, what in practice, how does one blend the two?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think because we have so many choices for schooling here in the U.S., you really have to look at what you're doing. Early math is important. If you're not, you know, and frankly, kids are not going to learn math unless you sit down and do it. if they're not getting that at school, maybe you need to supplement at home. You know, and I think that in the U.S., it's much more individual than for a Chinese family in China because their school is so regimented and formal and there's a national curriculum. So I think we need to be thinking about these issues. What are the weaknesses? What are the strengths? And how do we plug the weaknesses?
When I moved to the States, I moved to I chose where I lived based on the quality of the public schools. And I understood that it's generally a direct correlation with the property tax, right? So places with high property tax rates result in but I've come to realize that a lot of what I had heard in China about the educational system in the U.S. just wasn't true. One of the things that surprised me is the extent to which the school expects parental participation. Here in the U.S., mm-hmm. at least where I live in Chapel Hill, they really expect you to get very involved in their and the parents really do. They're always chatting with each other. Everyone sort of knows what the kids' projects are, and there you see it. It's quite uniform. You see a lot of parental participation in the work. You know, I go to drop the kids off at a birthday party, and everyone knows what everyone else is up to. They know the internal dynamics in the classroom. They have things to say about the teachers. I was really pleasantly surprised. I mean, I didn't think that it, you know, was the caricature of the American education system. Maybe it's just sort of, you know, because of where I ended up living. But I suspect you might have had, you know, well, me and others in mind when you talked about how, you know, we generally agree that the ideal upper limit in the Chinese system is sixth grade, possibly earlier, depending on the child. I think, you know, well, I nailed that. I mean, we moved when Gwenny turned six. We finished sixth grade. And there's a big difference, though. I mean, my son, fourth grade.
I said earlier, I wish my children had the same experience.
That's funny. How common is that? I mean, a lot of people say that?
Well, most of my friends, Chinese and foreign, who are lucky enough to have choices, have to say that. We feel that they'll pull out, you know, fourth, fifth grade. Some people don't last that long. Uh-huh. You know, because if you think about it, 3,500 characters by the end of fifth grade, that's a lot of characters. I mean, that's full basic literacy. And that means these kids are spending a lot of time drilling characters.
Oh, yeah. I really think, I mean, I've floated this theory on this podcast before. I really think that learning those characters where, you know, the logographs give you very little clue to the pronunciation and not that much of a clue to the semantic content either. You know, there is just sort of this mnemonic, hard crunching sort of leap that you need to make to learn Chinese. And that is good. I mean, you're making these abstract memorization feats, you know, 3,500 times just to be able to read at a rudimentary level. That wires your brain for other mnemonic tasks. I mean, so when you study OCHEM in college, you're going to do, you know, better at it. I was talking about this with my daughter. She's 13. I think she's pretty well adjusted. She's doing well in school. She's definitely making friends. She's pursuing creative outlets. She's doing, you know, a lot of writing, a lot of drawing. I've been telling her about your book and asked her from firsthand experience what she thought of the two different systems. And I think a lot of her friends have experienced exactly the same thing. So she was in an international school in Beijing. Half her classmates who graduated elementary school with her in Beijing moved to the U.S. for junior high or for middle school. I mean, literally half of them. It seems to be really, you know, a common thing, right? We were talking about the Finnish primary school in China. That way, you know, the Chinese will have stuck. I've met, you know, lots, just like you, lots of parents who sort of think the same thing. So what is it about sixth grade? Do you think, why sixth grade? What is it that character limit? Is it like that's when genuine adult level literacy has sunk in or what?
I think it's for, so the reason I think the upper limit is fifth or sixth grade is because after that, you start paying a lot of attention to entrance exams if you're in that system,
right?
Secondly, the Communist Party ideology starts intensifying at that level. And that's also the point at which if you've made it all the way through to fifth or sixth grade, you're purportedly literate. You're fully literate in Chinese. And so those are really the three reasons.
Yeah, so it's enough.
Johnny's not.
Basta.
Yeah.
Johnny's not because he left.
Right. I mean, he left after fourth grade. I mean, he's destined to lose his child. I just signed him up for a Chinese school, for a local, you know, Chinese school in Chapel Hill. You know, he doesn't really have the same sort of reflexive good study habits. He doesn't habitually pack his book bag every morning.
Well, that's the problem with Chinese education. If you're in it for too long and the demands become too rigorous and oppressive, then you start to rebel, or you start to fang qi, you start to abandon hope. And I saw that with these students that I was following in the countryside. Little Dreen Dreen, who is, you know, addicted to League of Legends at the age of 16, he'd been testing for so long. He knew exactly where he was going to fall. He knew he wasn't going to pass the high school entrance exam. And that's not great either, right?
No,
when I talk about hard work pays off in the classroom, that's really in the early years where there's still a lot of hope about a child's sort of educational progress. And all the language is about keeping these kids sort of on the ladder. And that's helpful. But again, too much of a good thing can become a bad thing. And that's the issue with education in China.
So you're pretty sure you're going to keep Rainey and Landon in school all the way through fifth or sixth grade?
We're trying. So he's only in third now. He's got a long road ahead. And he is now getting to the point where he's complaining about homework. You know, it's about an hour now. And that's fine. You know, it's funny. These California parents, I don't mean to bash on California parents. I raised, you know, Rainey was born in California. But they're asking me, isn't an hour of homework crushing his soul? And I said, well, he still has 5 or 6 hours outside of that hour to do other things. You know, there's not a correlation between having to work hard and crushing creative and, you know, independent expression. And I think that's the link that a lot of people are trying to make that doesn't exist.
Yeah, I think Dr. Spock is probably responsible for a lot of this.
No. Dr. Spock is pretty good child rearing stuff. I mean, it really has held up.
Yeah.
I think it's really helpful.
I just think that you can work hard. You can have high expectations for your child without, you really have to watch carefully, right? Our son's happy. You know, he's athletic. He's doing well in school. He's really all of these things. And this is really interesting. One of the reforms that came down last year, his school let out an hour early. Okay. Instead of 3 o'clock, it was going to be 2 o'clock. And this being China, they gave us a day's notice, right? So we're scrambling to figure out how, you know, what to do about childcare and what to do with our son for that extra hour. But they're shortening the school day. They're really trying to lighten the academic pressure. And so we're benefiting from all the changes that they're making, you know, rigor during the daytime and more free time at night.
Lenora, you have two boys. Did you, in your observation of Chinese schools, even you've observed a lot of classrooms, did you see sort of different treatment by gender?
That's a great question. You know, the teachers that I've encountered in Shanghai are fairly, for the most part, enlightened, and I didn't really hear them say anything odd. It's really the parents that treat their kids differently.
Okay.
You know, one girl that I interviewed, she was 16. She said, oh, if I fail the Gaokao, my mom says I can just get married, you know. So, you know, and the boys obviously have to come up with a house. See, everyone's saving money to buy houses for the boys so they can get married. So I think all the language is more cultural rather than around education.
Society generally.
Yeah.
Okay. Changing tack a little bit. Screens. This is a huge problem facing parents everywhere, or concerned parents in China.
Oh, God. Tell me about
as well as the United States. What do you do about screens? About phones and computers and iPads.
Ah, that's a great question.
Isn't this like the great anxiety all parents
parenting.
Are experiencing?
There was an article, are smartphones destroying a generation? You know, the Chinese have not really picked up onto this. You know how smoking, you know, there's not a lot of sort of the Surgeon General's health warnings about smoking. That hasn't really sunk in, right? Same thing, you know? Yeah, right? Same thing with smartphones. I mean, I see, you know, pretty moneyed, educated Chinese, and their kids are sort of on iPhones all the time, on their smartphones. Yeah. I don't think that message has sunk in.
You go to the restaurant, the whole family's on their devices.
On their devices.
It's just, yeah.
And, well, can I ask your own family's sort of policy on this?
No screens.
None at all.
Unless we're traveling.
Traveling, but otherwise no phone, like no games,
in the back
no
of the car
computer.
Or on the plane.
Yep.
Right? Wow.
But I think in the U.S., just every time I come back, and I've been spending a lot of time here over the last 8 years, the addiction to our screens just gets worse and worse. And I'm finding my friends who are frazzled working, and they come home, and the electronics have become a babysitter, right? And in China, I think, you know, there's Yeye or Nai Nai, or there's Aiyi. There's always somebody to sort of fill in that gap. Unfortunately, in the U.S., we don't have that.
Very few people have domestic help or grandparents who are willing to help out. Yeah, I've noticed Western grandparents are not the best at
electronic babysitters.
That's the excuse I'm going to use going forward.
Is that you don't have an eye, therefore you give your children iPads.
No, I mean, they've been terrible. I'm an absolute failure.
Well, you were playing computer games with your children when they were 6 months old, I think.
Oh, not quite that old. Only mildly violent ones.
That does depend on your definition of violence. For a man who has about 300 swords in his collection, that's not violent.
Lenora, so not long ago, I was having a beer with somebody who oversees a summer program, brings American students to China. And, you know, there are students from all over the world. So she's really able to compare. And she said that 100% of the students who are taking meds for mental health conditions were from the U.S. And 100% of them who had mental health issues, you know, who had these total, like, meltdowns during their time in China were from the U.S., not from any of the European countries, not from any of the Middle East or North African countries, not from East Asia, certainly. What's going on here? I mean, was this something that you looked at all? I mean, this woman was by no means some arch conservative who laments the whole coddling and pampering of American students, but still, I mean, she couldn't help but, you know, report this to me that this is really kind of disturbing. I've talked to a lot of other people. I mean, like, you know, our friend David Moser, who runs the CET program, in the academic program there, he has to deal with this all the time. I started asking around people who've run programs. This is an issue.
The Americans are crazy.
Don't you feel like it's a little bit overparenting, helicopter parenting, where I feel that our kids in the U.S. are kind of anxious, you know?
Yeah.
And David Moser's kids are probably pretty, I mean, these are pretty well-educated kids generally, right?
Absolutely.
They come from good families. But I think there's a lot of academic pressure here in the U.S., just like there is in China, you know, for these Shanghai teenagers too. And maybe
they're
that's
not
contributing
all on Prozac,
to it.
Right?
But isn't that also partly connected with the kind of clinicalization of
that's true. That's great
unhappiness in America?
That's a great question. And it's funny because we've gone overboard. I mean, we you know, some people say that we overdiagnose, you know, ADHD and these kinds of things. And in China, there's no diagnosis going on at all. I've been in the back of classrooms where clearly, you know, there's a girl who's somewhere on the autistic spectrum disorder. And I asked the teacher, what's going to happen to her? And she said, well, not only is there nothing in the system to support her, her parents refuse to acknowledge a problem. And at some point, she'll just drop out of the system. And so you have here, you know, that's a system that really emphasizes group over the individual. There's nothing to help that individual girl because it doesn't serve the larger group. And there's not the resources. Here in the U.S., we have the resources and we have, you know, the doctors and you know, are we going a little bit overboard? That's the question.
I would say definitely. I mean, it's not just mental health. I mean, you know, gluten-free bullshit. I mean, I'm shocked. You know, you see steak sold with gluten-free advertising.
Well, Jeremy, you're the one who's living in the hippie enclave, as you said, right?
No, hillbilly enclave.
Okay, different. All right.
Well, with hippie teachers, though. And what about peanut allergies?
Allergies, I mean, you know, ridiculous.
People get angry notes for having sex. You know, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to school now.
Think this is an issue too? I talk to teachers and I think it's an issue. You know, an entire school is expected to sort of ban, you know, peanuts from lunchboxes because of one food allergic kid. And I understand there, you know, we should be grateful that we're at a point in society where we can do this, right? But the question is where on the balance, you know?
So before we wrap, let's talk a little bit about the media reception. And I think, you know, it's weird. Did you read the same book that I did? That kind of thing. I mean, what's going on?
I don't know. I think so.
I think let's set that up a bit better. Okay. I mean, some of the commentary on your book doesn't seem to have really understood what it's about, right? That's what you mean, Kaiser.
It's weirdly binary, right?
It is binary. That's a great question. I think because this book really takes a look at what the good, let's just call it the good, the bad, and the different of Chinese education, right? There's some things the Chinese think they're not doing well and things that they're trying to fix and things that they're very proud of. And when you have this kind of balanced narrative, the media comes really strongly on one side or another. I've had headlines saying, why American students need Chinese schools, as if, you know, you have an entire country here that needs to be Chinified.
I saw that one. That's the journal one, right?
That's the Wall Street Journal headline. On the flip side, you have, you know, people have described my book as Little Soldiers Unveils the Draconian System of the Chinese. You know, it's really interesting and it's a little frustrating as a writer to have this, you know, out there in the world and have people take such different takes on it. And I just hope people read the book because they will understand how complex, you know, China is and Chinese education and even this urban-rural divide. And, you know, there's so many things that you can say about it.
Nuance doesn't sell newspapers, though.
That's true.
I mean, in some ways, Amy Chua, with her, you know, Tiger Mother book, had a similar reception. I mean, the book itself,
she
played it up herself. I mean,
I think, you know,
and it certainly helped sell the book.
Right.
Yeah, so maybe you shouldn't worry about that.
Yeah, maybe you should learn something.
Well, you know, I've been out there talking on the road as a journalist, and I try to present both sides, and I think maybe it's a little bit confusing. I don't know. You know, it's,
people don't like nuance.
I don't know about that. But I feel like it's hard to write that into a headline. That's
true.
Totally,
I mean, I think the media is in a stage right now where clickbait is very important, where people's attention, there's so much battling for people's attentions. I had a conversation with a let's just say Washington Post editor the other day. They put something like 700 pieces of content up on their screen a day. And if something's not moving within an hour, it's off. I mean, that's how fast you have to capture somebody's attention.
Oh, God.
Isn't that crazy? So, you know, so that's, and that's fine. But, you know, I don't know what else I want to say about it.
Well, it is also an emotional subject that, you know, there's aspects of the fear of the rise of China in it that I think also, you know, lend it towards a non-nuanced interpretation.
That's a great point. I also think people are bringing their own preconceptions to the issue. It's China, first of all. It's either fear and revulsion, or, oh, China's great, or China's something to be scared of, or it's an economic giant. You know, it's always polarizing. It's always, there's always a superlative in there. You know, and people have ideas that they bring to the table. And I think that's contributing to some of the media headlines.
Well, the truth is, China is the first time that sort of the American paradigm has been challenged in any serious way. I mean,
that's right.
On
every
so
level,
many different dimensions.
Forms,
yeah,
of government.
Absolutely.
How you educate your children.
Just basically, yeah.
How you grow an economy.
Exactly.
Everything.
Exactly.
And then there's the problem that I think we did a podcast the other day with Gary Lill from the South China Morning Post, which might actually air after this one. But he was saying that, oh, it was Jamil Andolini, the FT correspondent,
right,
Asia bureau chief, I think he is now, who said that there are three stories about China in the Western media. It's
big
China, scary China, or repressive China.
Bad China.
Bad China. Big China, bad China, and weird China.
That's a great way to put it. Right.
Big China, bad China, weird China.
Which is, yeah, right. Very
I've probably
very
had
true.
Headlines that fall into all three categories.
Yeah.
You know, they can say whatever they want about my book as long as people read it.
Yeah, no, as long as they buy it.
You know, Jeremy, that was actually in our dinner conversation with Gary afterwards, so that won't be in the podcast itself. But yeah, that was, I think, a fascinating thing.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He said other things about Jamil Anderlini that we're not going to talk about. Anyway, Lenora, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. And before we wrap, let's say we offer our listeners some recommendations. But first, I want to remind our listeners that the Cynical Podcast is powered by SupChina.com. Sign up for our free daily email newsletter, download our app, visit our website, or just follow us on Twitter and Facebook. On Twitter, we are at SupChina News, and on Facebook, we are at Facebook.com/SupChinaNews. And if you enjoy the Cynical Podcast, please leave us a positive review on the Apple iTunes Store or on Google Play. Thanks in advance. Now, onward to recommendations, as is our habit. Jeremy, kick us off.
I'm going to recommend something I read just today, it will hopefully still be timely next week because we won't have all died in a nuclear holocaust. It's an article titled "To Deter North Korea, Japan and South Korea Should Go Nuclear." And the author...
By Donald Trump.
Yeah. It's not Donald Trump. The author is a gentleman named Bilhari Kausikan, who is the former permanent secretary of Singapore's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And whether you agree with him or not, it's a very interesting argument.
We're going to be talking to a former Singaporean diplomat very soon, and we'll see if he agrees with
Yeah, I'm going to ask him about that.
Yeah, we'll be talking to Kishore Mahbubani very, very soon, so we're very excited about that. That's interesting. So do you buy that argument?
I'm not sure. I mean, yeah, I don't know. He makes a compelling argument. I mean, the argument is essentially that there's no way to stop North Korea's nuclear program, and the only way to stop disaster is deterrence. But America cannot be enough of a deterrence, because America is not going to sacrifice San Francisco for Japan. Therefore, Japan needs the bomb. Therefore, South Korea will want the bomb.
I mean,
and this
surely,
will, of course, piss off China.
Exactly.
But the argument is that what will end up is a sort of a state that is much more stable than the current situation.
Okay.
So I don't know if I agree or not. I'm still thinking about it.
Where is that article?
In the Washington Post.
Okay, interesting. All right, Lenora, what do you have for us?
So Ellen Pao launched a book the same day that I did. She's that Silicon Valley Kleiner Perkins, a woman who is, you know, sort of talking about pulling the curtain back on gender issues in
the
tech world.
Who, what happened exactly with her? She was fired or?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And then filed a lawsuit for gender discrimination. And she has a memoir out called Reset. And I met her on the set of CBS This Morning because our books launched the same day. And I just think that she has a really interesting story. I have not read the book yet, but it's next on my reading list.
Oh, absolutely. So she went on to be CEO of Reddit, actually. Right. So she's had, you know, a pretty illustrious career since. So
that's right. She's a former CEO of Reddit.
She's really, mm-hmm. really brilliant. I mean, I follow her on social media, and she's super smart. And she was maybe, you know, one of the first. But look what's happened in Silicon Valley in the time since she's written that book. I mean, there it's you know, it's like full Harvey Weinstein now. I mean, there are a lot of people coming forward to, you know,
talking about gender discrimination, right, and harassment.
The other person who is just so good on this topic of women in technology is Tracy Cho, C-H-O-U. Tracy Cho, she's a Taiwanese-American woman, graduated from Stanford, has worked at Quora, is an engineer at Pinterest. She's an engineer herself. She's brilliant and really, really articulate on issues of gender in Silicon Valley. And she happens also to be, you know, like Ellen Pao, Chinese American like us. Awesome. That's a great recommendation. I'm looking forward to reading that.
Sorry to delay this podcast's conclusion, but I actually, just while we're on the subject, Kaiser, I mean, you worked at Baidu, one of China's biggest technology companies. How would you compare the state of sexism in Chinese tech?
That is
compared
a great
to
question.
Silicon
Valley? Yeah. So no, I think it's fascinating. I think that in some ways, companies like Baidu were doing very, very well, and others, they simply weren't. So if you look at the really senior management, the echelons of senior management, at various points, you know, a good 30 or 40% of VPs and above were female. Problem is, very few of them were actually in technology positions. So we had people in finance, we had people in, you know, marketing or in PR. We had some VP level senior engineers, like a woman named Wang Mengqiu, but you know, she left. We had, of course, our CFO. For a very long time, for 8 or 9 years, was a woman and a very ardent and very effective feminist named Jennifer Lee, who I worked under. So she was great. But in the rank and file, so it was, I think, 43% female. But if you look at just the product teams or
just the engineers,
the engineering teams, it was you know, a pathetically low number.
Not that different from the US.
Not really nearly that different. But you know, in terms of the ethics of the place, so there were a lot of problems. Like, you know, HR companies in would still routinely ask about pregnancy plans. They would, you know, you were still, you know, submitting pictures with your resume. I mean, a lot of things like that, you know, they're asking you whether you were married or single. These are problems. But this is, you know, this is not Baidu. This is a China-wide problem. Well, this is not just the tech companies. And I think they were a little more enlightened than most. You know, there were, you know, some pretty deep-rooted problems. But Jeremy, we should do a show about that.
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's do a whole show on that. But let me move on with my recommendation. So it's actually, since we're talking about women in power, my recommendation is for a local politician in my town, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Election day is coming up and early voting starts very, very soon. So if you have a friend or someone in your family who lives in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, tell that person to get out there and cast a vote for Hongbin Gu Hongbin, for Chapel Hill Town Council. She is the real deal. I've rarely
Chinese as well as a woman.
Yeah, so no, wow. she's an American citizen, of course. And no, actually, so she's deeply progressive. She's not, she doesn't run on, you know, with a partisan, I mean, she's running technically independent, but so it, you know, she's more progressive. I mean, she's deeply progressive. But what's interesting about her is that in spite of that, so I've never met anyone like her. I mean, she says just such conspicuous natural leadership capabilities. That type of a charisma. So she's a psychiatric researcher, quantitative psychiatric researcher at UNC, PhD from UNC. She's from Shanghai originally, has a really interesting life story, just a really brilliant woman. She's a very committed progressive, and what I noticed her because she was, so she's quite the figure in our Chinese American community there. She was for many years the principal of the local Chinese school, which is a huge Chinese school, really, really, you know, good sized Saturday afternoon Chinese school. She, though, in during the summer when you know, our Weixin, our WeChat groups were just filled with angry Trumpers yelling at you know, support progressives online. She really stepped up and in a rational and calm and quite deliberate and forceful way, just shut down a lot of that kind of like ad hominem attack and the argument. She was so effective at it. So now I look, you know, because I'm working on her campaign, so many of the people there are people I recognize from those groups who were real, you know, Trumper types, but they're supporting her and, you know, falling in line pretty well. So I'm really impressed with her. She's a true leader.
I hadn't realized that you didn't like Donald Trump.
Oh, really? Yeah. She's definitely one to watch, and she's a rising star, I think, among Chinese Americans in the world of politics. I'm sure many of our listeners have friends in Chapel Hill, so make sure to reach out, let them know, vote for Gu Hongbin, Hongbin Gu, and early voting starts soon. This message brought to you by Lenora, thanks once again, and we wish you a really great book tour and prosperity in your book sales.
Thanks for this opportunity, guys. Great
Jeremy,
to see you.
Man, great to be in New York with you as always.
Oh, yeah.
So, the Cynical Podcast is powered by SupChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo, that's me, and Jeremy Goldhorn.
That's me.
Drop us an email at cynica@supchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/supchinanews and follow us on Twitter at supchinanews. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.